Hello, it's Thursday the 23rd of September and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Moon Jae-in has once again called on the need to formally declare the end of the Korean War after making a similar call at the UN General Assembly earlier this week. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly, and then later on Korean Politics Digest, we'll discuss why he might be making these calls now with our regular expert guest, as well as look at the latest updates in the presidential primaries. And then on Explore Korea, we continue our Feel the Rhythm of Korea series, this week looking at the locations featured in the Daegu and Suncheon episodes of the KTO video series. We'll have all that and more coming up next. South Korean President Moon Jae-in reiterated his calls to declare a formal end to the Korean War, saying this will offer new hope and courage to everyone wishing for peace around the world. To give us the details from the president's speech, as well as our other headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So Moon has, for the second time in as many days, called on relevant nations to help formally end the 70-odd-year conflict with North Korea as he prepared to escort home the remains of 68 South Korean soldiers from Hawaii.
Indeed. Moon speaking at a joint repatriation ceremony for war remains at Hickam Air Force Base in Honolulu said complete peace on the Korean Peninsula is what these fallen heroes would want most. He was preparing to escort home these remains of the soldiers who served in the Korean War, identified by the U.S. Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. Hawaii serves as the headquarters of the Pentagon Agency in charge of searching and identifying remains of American soldiers that went missing or were killed in action. Together with South Korean authorities, it also identifies remains of South Koreans who fought alongside their U.S. brothers in arms. This marks the first time a South Korean president has personally hosted such an event abroad. Now, you may recall Moon suggested in his Tuesday address at the UN that the two Koreas, the U.S. and possibly China, jointly push for such a declaration to usher in an era of reconciliation and cooperation. The Korean War Armistice was signed in July 1953 by military commanders from the U.S., representing UN command, and North Korea and China. No peace treaty was ever signed in the conflict.
Right. President Moon has repeatedly urged an end to the conflict, both at home and abroad, especially in his address at the UN General Assembly. What's been the response so far?
Well, the Pentagon said that the U.S. is open to discussing a possible declaration of an end to the Korean War. According to Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby on Wednesday, the U.S. continues to seek engagement with North Korea and is open to such discussions. Defense officials from the two nations will likely discuss further on the matter when they meet in Seoul next week for the 20th Korea-U.S. Integrated Defense Dialogue. China also backed Moon's calls. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said on Wednesday that ending the constant state of war and shifting to a peace regime is an important part of the political resolution of the Korean Peninsula issues and universal expectations of the international community. Still, there are hazards ahead on the road to peace, namely North Korea's nuclear ambitions. In a report on the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022 on Wednesday, the U.S. Senate counted North Korea and Iran among rogue states that threaten the U.S. and its allies with their weapons development programs. And North Korea has yet to respond to Moon's latest speech.
Meanwhile, we also saw back-to-back discussions among the diplomatic chiefs from South Korea, the US, and Japan on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York, where, unsurprisingly, North Korea featured as a major topic of discussion.
Indeed. South Korean Foreign Minister Chung Yong, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Japanese Foreign Minister Toshimitsu Motegi held trilateral and bilateral discussions on the heels of North Korea's recent series of long-range cruise and ballistic missiles tests. Seoul's foreign ministry said that three sides assessed the recent situation on the Korean Peninsula and agreed to strengthen diplomatic efforts to advance efforts for complete denuclearization and permanent peace on the peninsula. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, also attended the trilateral meeting, suggesting that sending humanitarian aid to the North may also have been discussed.
Now, Foreign Minister Chung also made an interesting comment, saying there is no need for South Korea to choose between the U.S. and China, and that Seoul is not being forced to do so. Can you tell us more?
Yes, Chung speaking at a discussion organized by the Council on Foreign Relations on Wednesday made the remarks when asked by a reporter if there is a need for Seoul to choose one over the other. Chung also said he doesn't agree with the view that the Indo-Pacific is divided into a China bloc and a non-China bloc, and that the US, South Korea and Japan make up the latter. Chung, he said, he hopes that the U.S. and China will be able to have a more stable relationship. On North Korea, Chung said there is a need to propose a compensation plan to the North with snapback provisions in order to make headway in denuclearization and to consider easing sanctions on Pyongyang. Chung said there is no need to be overly prudent in making the compensation offer, adding that providing humanitarian aid, which is less sensitive, could help jumpstart the process.
Let's turn our attention now to the COVID-19 situation here in South Korea. Health authorities announced that starting Friday, fully vaccinated people will not have to undergo a mandatory 14-day self-quarantine after coming into close contact with a COVID-19 patient if they have no symptoms. Can you tell us more and then break down the latest figures for us as well?
Of course. The Korea Disease Prevention and Control Agency announced the eased guidelines on Thursday, saying they adjusted the rules, taking into account the pace of vaccinations and the spread of variants. Health authorities are tentatively beginning to introduce regulations ahead of shifting to a system that helps manage the population to live with COVID-19. The government had initially required self-isolation for vaccinated people who came into contact with a COVID patient if they had come into one infected with variants such as the highly transmissible Delta strain. The exemption for fully vaccinated people applied to those even if they had indeed come into contact with patients with such strains. Health authorities will announce next week fourth quarter vaccination plans, including those for teens, pregnant women, and the unvaccinated. Meanwhile, the KDCA reported 1,716 additions on Thursday, with the daily tally remaining in the 1,700s for a third day. This brings the cumulative total to 292,699. The Greater Seoul Metro Area reported 1,292 domestic cases, accounting for 76.1% of all local transmissions.
And finally, opposing factions have continued to wrangle over suspicions that presidential contender and Gyeonggi Province Governor Lee Jae-myung handed out favours to close associates in a public property development project several years ago. Can you give us the latest?
Yes, the opposition faction, led by the main People Power Party, jointly sought an independent council and a parliamentary inspection into favoritism allegations surrounding the ruling Democratic Party's leading presidential contender. On Thursday, PPP and the smaller People's Party submitted a special prosecution bill motioned by all of their 107 combined representatives. They also called for a parliamentary investigation. The special prosecution bill aims to investigate allegations of favoritism, leaked classified information, power abuse and embezzlement surrounding the Daejangdong development project pursued by Songnam City in 2014 and 2015 when he served as mayor. The ruling party, meanwhile, said it is not considering responding to the opposition's calls, saying that the prosecution has already launched a probe and the allegations can also be addressed by parliamentary committees. Lee's camp accused the opposition parties of a political offensive and threatened to seek exemplary damages for slander and false reporting against local daily Joseon Ilbo, which first reported on these allegations. Justice Minister Park Bom-ye said on Thursday that he believes swift action is necessary to address these suspicions.
That'll be all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Welcome to our Thursday in-depth segment, Korean Politics Digest, taking a deep dive into some of the major political issues of the week. We'll kick off by looking at President Moon Jae-in's keynote address at the UN General Assembly, where he repeated a call for a declaration to formally end the Korean War. After that, we'll talk about public support for the main opposition People Power Party, reaching a record high of 40% approval ratings in a recent survey. As for the ruling Democratic Party, its presidential primary in the Cholla region is underway, and results there will likely serve as a precursor of the final primary outcome. To help us discuss all of these issues in detail, our regular expert guest, Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies, joins us on the line today. Professor, hello, and hope you had a good Chuseok.
Yeah, I had a good time. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, we're going to begin with something a little different, beginning with President Moon Jae-in's final address before the UN General Assembly in New York on Tuesday. He reiterated a call to formally end the Korean War, and he also proposed that either three parties consisting of the two Koreas and the United States, or four parties with the addition of China, come together and declare that the war on the Korean Peninsula is over. So, Professor, what's your overall assessment of President Moon's speech?
I went over his entire text here, and it was a decent speech. He made it clear that he's coming back to the physically in person to the General Assembly floor first time in 2 years. That means he gave the speech last year virtually. So, coming back in person, he was covering wide range of issues such as issue of emphasizing the global community, Korea as one of the leading members he wants to see, and like a global community having to overcome the pandemic together. And he talked about the 2030 SDG Sustainable Development Goals, which is a very important piece of UN, addressing the heart of the UN in doing so. Along with that, he also talked about climate change, and also in November, Korea is going to actually upgrade Korea's commitment for climate change, which is called NDC and so on. So he was covering all these issues very widely, but of course, towards the end, for the third time altogether in his career as Korean president giving speech at the UN General Assembly, he mentioned for the third time the need for the declaration to end the Korean War. And this is, I think he made the same point back in 2018. That was the exciting year for him when he had meetings with Kim Jong-un and then Trump, Kim Jong-un meeting, the first one there. So 2018 was the first time, and then I guess last year he raised the issue of the need for the declaration. But this time, as you mentioned, the difference is he mentioned specifically three-party or four-party, either U.S., North Korea, and South Korea, three-party, or U.S., North Korea, South Korea, and China, four-party agreement or the joint declaration of the ending of the Korean War. Our listeners, some of the overseas listeners may wonder what is the declaration of ending the war. Well, the thing is, you know, technically, the Korean War never ended. This is an armistice we have, and it's a ceasefire situation we are here.
Right.
And from the perspective of those people who support the idea of declaration of, you know, ending the war, once we have that in place, we can talk about measures such as disarmament, including denuclearization and the permanent measures to seek peace and so on. So those who want to see steps made towards permanent peace, of course, conceptually speaking, this is an important step to go through. And of course, there's no doubt on the side of President Moon Jae-in, he thinks the same way.
Mm. But what do you make the timing of this move? Why do you think he's pushing it now, considering that he doesn't have long in his presidency left? He will be stepping down in May 2022, of course. He again mentioned this during the Seoul and Washington's joint repatriation ceremony for war remains in Honolulu, Hawaii, on Wednesday as well. What do you make of the timing?
Yeah, facing that question, a lot of people wonder this. I mean, the timing itself, it's only about 8 months he has on his watch before the election, and then maybe 10 months time before he leaves the office. Election is March, and then the new government will come in May. So extremely tight schedule. So the easy answer to that would be it's just his efforts to solidify his legacy in terms of what he has achieved during his time or tried to achieve what he has worked on. One of the key main points, and he wanted to just highlight that was the main point he was working on. That's one. Another more practical side, if we assume that he really means to get something done in the remaining time, 8 years before the presidential election or 8 months before the presidential election or 10 months before his departure from the office, how can we make this happen? Well, the thing is, I guess when Wang Yi, a Chinese foreign minister, visited Seoul just a week ago or so, there may have been certain tacit agreement between Beijing and Seoul that China will play a more active role in making this happen. And, China will take a lead, perhaps, which China was never a part of, indeed, in past discussions and so on. And when we say China, why China? The thing is, next year, February, we have a Beijing Winter Olympic Games. And that could be an interesting timing for declaring, if all parties agree, declaring the end of Korean War. So China has a bigger stake here, and so that probably is one explanation. However, on the side of pessimists, of course, things have not been going ahead at all ever since the February 19th, 2019. That is what almost 2 years and a half, whole process of working with North Korea has been freeze. So pessimists have their voice here saying, 2.5 years, no move, and now remaining 8 to 10 months here, talking about this, not very likely. Then fundamentally, those pessimists, when they say so, of course, they have in mind United States interests. United States, the conservatives in Washington, are very much concerned. When you declare end of the war, it could be used. Such declaration may be abused by North Korea, Pyongyang, saying, well, war has ended, so U.S. troops out. That is a big concern in the minds of people who are hesitant about this. But of course, officially today, this morning, I guess, U.S. Defense Department spokesperson said United States government is open about it. I think it's in words, but there are many different calculations about whether this is realistic at all in the remaining time schedule.
Sure, there's a lot more to unpack, but we're going to have to leave that there as we have some more domestic politics issues to look at as well today. A recent poll has shown that public support for the main opposition People Power Party has risen to hit 40% for the first time in a RealMeter weekly survey. In the poll of 2,517 adults between last Monday and Friday, 40% of respondents said they supported the Conservative main opposition, up 2.9 percentage points from a week earlier. On the contrary, support for the ruling Liberal Democratic Party fell 0.1 percentage point to 32.5%. Now, the survey commissioned by YTN had a confidence level of 95% with a margin of error of plus or minus 2 percentage points. Professor, how do you size up these survey results?
It is interesting that the People's Power Party is actually setting the record as ever since the downfall of Park Geun-hye, previous president. This is the highest point that they're making. They have broken record before. So overall, the trend is upward. That's something that political analysts are noticing, because for in the eyes of political analysts, trend is really always important rather than specific numbers. But in talking about specific numbers, in the polls that you have just mentioned of the details of just so far, what we have noticed is, of course, as the People's Power Party, the main opposition, reaches this 40% mark, the highest level, President Moon Jae-in, he's still around kind of like a 40% right there, like at the bottom of it. And then even though he's showing some drops, that's one of the reasons why the opposition probably gained. But level of support, approval rating for Moon Jae-in is around 40%, or maybe it could go down to the higher end of 30% or so. That's a considerably high level we have seen. Most of the previous president in Korea towards the end of the term, they suffered from very low approval ratings. So what we are seeing here is very, very interesting. Well, a considerably high level of support for the opposition. And, of course, the ruling party here, their support level is about 30%. So 30% support level for ruling party, a 40% support level for the opposition party, which is considerably high. But at the same time, the sitting president is enjoying around 40. So this is giving us altogether very, very much mixed signal. And what it tells us basically is that the people are not as much, people are not so electrified about the upcoming election. They're not that excited, and anything could happen. I think that's what it means. And there is no rock solid support. I mean, there may be rock solid support for the core supporters on each side, but the thing is, there's no firm support that indicates any real victory for any side. Lee Jae-myung, he has his rock solid support among his core supporters, but they don't add up really as the firm majority at the end. So everything is really, really in flux. That probably is the message we should be reading in these confusing numbers, I think.
Right. So then, do you think the PPP can maintain this high level of support ratings moving forward, or do you think this is just a spike for now?
I think one of the key variable in answering that question would be what will happen by the time they finalize their candidate, Yoon Suk-yeol, Hong Jun-pyo, or whoever else, if they can generate enough excitement on the side of PPP, that will mean they will continue to go up. But if somehow they fail to do so, generating excitement, presenting their final candidate to the Korean people, and Korean people say, oh, well, then nothing can be guaranteed. I think their party convention or final stage of their candidate selection will be the critical variable or factor in determining which way they're going to go.
Let's move on to the ruling Democratic Party now, and specifically their presidential primary race. Regional primary votes in the Gwangju, South Cholla province and North Cholla provinces, together called Honam, began last Saturday and Sunday, respectively. Now, some say the results in the Honam region, which has 200,000 electoral college votes, is highly likely to determine the final outcome of the party primary. For our listeners, Professor, could you lay out the importance of the Cholla region for the DP presidential contenders?
Cholla and Honam region is basically, with some rough exaggeration, we can say it's basically home base for Democratic Party, the Progressive Party, while, for example, TK, Daegu Gyeongbuk area, or even Gyeongsang area in a broader sense, is home base for the Conservative Party, PPP, despite all what all happened to previous President Park Geun-hye and so on. So you got to win. You have to win at your home base in order to become the candidate. And so that's why the regional competition in Honam area is so critical for the candidates of the ruling Democratic Party. It's a simple and straightforward there.
Do you think the Gyeonggi province governor, Lee Jae-myung, will grab another victory in Honam? Because this comes at a time when he is battling allegations that he granted special treatment in regards to a development project in the Daejang district in Panggyo, just south of Seoul, where he served as mayor of Seongnam. Could this supposed scandal weigh down his race and help lead former DP chairman Lee Nak-yeon, who's in second place, turn things around and try to catch up to him?
Talking about Governor Lee Jae-myung, I'm mindful of his past record for the past several years, even spending more than 4 or 5 years, the previous election when he was running for the party ticket and so on. This is a person who has come through so many different, very controversial scandals before. And I wonder how this Daejangdong scandal measures up to the previous scandals, when he was doing mayor. Is this big enough deal or not? We need all the facts. So, as voters, we need, as the public will actually elect our president, we need to know everything. But at this point, with the information we got, I wonder whether this is a big enough of scandal or challenge he faces, because I'm mindful again that he seems to have faced challenges bigger than this. But the new facts could change all this. So I'm closely watching at the moment.
Yes, much like some of the scandals surrounding the PPP candidate Yoon Sung-yeol as well, there's a lot of murky details for now, not a lot of clear facts. So I guess we still need to see how these investigations do proceed to see what does come out of these scandals.
Right.
Professor, we have time just to ask one more question today. The presidential elections, as we said, are there less than 6 months away now. And there's a lot of focus on young voters as they're expected to play a decisive role in who wins. That's because in the by-elections in April, they bucked the usual trend of young people voting towards more liberal, progressive candidates and parties, and they voted for conservative candidates, helping the PPP win key mayoral races in Seoul and Busan, and especially young men in their 20s and 30s voting this way. And they're also said to be responsible for the ascent of the 36-year-old politician Lee Jun-suk, who was elected PPP chair in June. So a lot of changes. Why do you think young voters are turning towards the conservative PPP, and how important do you think their vote will be in March?
Young people are turning towards PPP and away from DP because they feel that all this ideological background, the backdrop that DPP is bringing to the public, is something that they don't understand. They didn't experience before. I mean, their stance towards North Korea, Japan, the United States, their stance on welfare, all these things. DP's stance has a lot to do with the Korea's experience during the 80s and then 90s, democratization process and so on. But this is something that young generation didn't experience themselves. So a lot of these things, basic assumptions that DP is laying on the ground before they make up their argument, don't come home easily to the young people. So that's why, they are easily turned off by some of the strong policy directions of the DP. So that explains. And why are these young generation, young voters important? Well, their numbers. First of all, in terms of talking about their numbers, we have to pay attention to their voting participation and the actual headcount. I guess the voting participation, they're well known for their low level of participation. We saw it once again, the latest one in the latest votes, the Seoul and Busan city mayor. Again, their voting participation ratio was much lower than the older generation for sure. The thing is, in terms of headcount, however, in Seoul and Busan, I have numbers showing here that if you add up the, those voters in their 20s and 30s, excluding the youngest people, like up until 19, who cannot vote, but the, those people who can vote, still their numbers are larger than the older voters in their 60s and 70s and so on. So these are considerable voting blocks that, that any ambitious politician should pay close attention to. So they're potentially important. The question is, how are you going to excite them enough to bring them to the ballots? That will be the real challenge. In the previous presidential elections, they participated quite actively, but still their participation is something that they really need to work on, those politicians who want to have their votes.
Professor, a very quick answer. Do you think the young men, they're turning more conservative, or they're just voting against the current party in charge?
Absolutely, they're turning conservative. I've seen them with my eyes. In the classrooms that I teach college students, young men, they're turning conservative. They do not like the stances of the ruling party and then the current government, the way they deal with North Korea and the foreign affairs issues, and also distribution, welfare. They are very much concerned about the fiscal balance. They are turning indeed conservative big time, at least those young male students I've watched with my own eyes.
Well, I'd like to hear more about your first-hand experiences with your students especially, but for now, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Professor, thank you as always for your thoughts, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 12.93 points, or 0.41%, on Thursday, closing the day at 3,127.58. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 9.86 points, or 0.94%, to close at 1,036.26. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 0.51 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,175.51. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment covering some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And with those stories for us is Chung Yeowon, who I'm delighted to say joins us in the studio today. Yeowon, hello. It's good to see you again.
Hello, Changul.
So what topics do you have for us today?
First, we'll be talking about electricity rates being raised in the country for the first time since 2013. Next, we'll discuss the global recognition the South Korean-made Netflix series Squid Game has been getting. Lastly, we'll talk about the Korean Derby, as it was called on local media, that took place between Son Heung-min and Hwang Hee-chan in the English League Cup competition.
Okay, so we start with a story that will not be welcomed by most Korean people, I believe. Bills will be going up, specifically electricity bills. Can you tell us more?
The South Korean government and the state-run Korea Electric Power Corporation raised electricity rates for the first time in about 8 years. It was announced on Thursday that the discount of 3 won per kilowatt hour would end from the fourth quarter. And this means that a four-person household using an average of 350 kilowatt hour a month could face up to a 1,051 increase in its bills for the next 3 months.
Right, so an increase of up to 1,051 per month. So what was the reason for this change?
It's due to the sharp rise in fuel prices such as coal and liquefied natural gas. You see, at the end of last year, KEPCO reorganized its electricity rate system and introduced a new fuel cost index system. This was to reduce their earnings volatility stemming from international fuel prices. Accordingly, the cost of purchasing fuel, such as oil, coal, and liquefied natural gas, will be reflected in the electricity rate for the fourth quarter.
Okay, so this rise had been expected for a while, so it wasn't a surprise. But as for implications, with the consumer price inflation rate being in the 2% range for 5 months in a row now, there will be growing concerns over rising inflationary pressure. Okay, let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
The Netflix original series Squid Game, known as Ojingeo Game in Korean, has topped the U.S. charts, which is a first for South Korean-made content on the streaming platform. According to FlixPatrol, an online video streaming database, the 9-episode series took first place in the Netflix top 10 in the United States on Monday and Tuesday. It has won over Sex Education that was raved about well before its release, as well as the thriller drama Clickbait.
Wow, so number one in the States for a non-English series. That's pretty incredible. And I'm going to guess it's safe to assume that Squid Game is doing pretty well globally overall as well.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The show's popularity has spanned over the globe from Asia, the Americas, and the Middle East as well. In fact, it places within the top three in most countries where Netflix is streaming. And as a TV show, it's ranked second globally on the platform. Although there has been outstanding performance from Korean series, such as Sweet Home from 2020 being the first to enter the Netflix top 10 in the U.S., and Kingdom Ashen of the North climbing to ninth place this July, Squid Game is the first to occupy the top spot. What's more is that Squid Game has a 100% freshness index on Rotten Tomatoes, a global critic site. The series also scored an 8.3 out of 10 on entertainment portal IMDb, showing that the popularity of the show has been recognized by critics and viewers around the world.
Yes, that is indeed impressive. But for anyone who might not have heard of the series, can you tell us more about what it's about?
Sure. It tells the story of those who participate in a mysterious survival game with a prize of 45.6 billion won, over 48,000 USD, risking their lives to become the ultimate winner. It has drawn much sympathy by depicting people in modern society as well as their nature of tyranny and desperation to win at any cost. However, the reaction at home is divided due to its close resemblance to the Japanese cartoon Kaiji and the movie As the Gods Will. Some critics have commented on poor acting skills and tension development, claiming that the show is an example of Keishinpa, a localized term based on Shinpa, a form of Japanese theater typically featuring melodramatic stories. Such critics have said that this new wave of Keishinpa has been a bit excessive as of late.
I see. So not universally praised, but the high concept has attracted attention as well as some of its social commentary aspects. Do be advised, though, for any listeners who might be interested, it is also very violent and gruesome, so it's not for the faint-hearted. Right, what's our last story of the day?
We'll be ending off with news of South Korean footballers Son Heung-min and Hwang Hee-chan's first match against each other on Thursday, with Son's Tottenham Hotspur edging out Hwang's Wolverhampton Wanderers 3-2 in a penalty shootout and advancing to the round of 16 in the Carabao Cup.
I see, so it must have been a tight game seeing as the teams ended up in a penalty shootout.
Indeed. Spurs lost their 2-0 lead when Wolves equalized after 58 minutes. The move that led to the equalizer started off with Hwang, who snatched the ball from Spurs with strong pressure, which allowed for Daniel Podence to put the ball in the back of the net after receiving a pass from Leander Dendonker. In fact, Wolves almost took it when midfielder Ruben Neves' shot hit the crossbar at just 2 minutes left. And in the shootout, it was Neves who shot way over the crossbar to allow Spurs to take the lead with Brian Gill's successful attempt. Dendonker then had his shot blocked, sealing the deal for Spurs. With their 3-2 victory, Spurs will be facing Burnley next in the round of 16.
Yes, it sounds like it was an exciting game. Now, understand Hwang, who just made his Premier League debut less than 2 weeks ago now, this game was his first match as a starter for Wolves. How did he fare against the Premier League stalwart in Son, although understand Son only came on as a second-half substitute?
Although this was an exciting Korean derby match debut of the season, neither player was able to get a goal or an assist. But after the tough match, Son and Hwang were seen smiling and greeting each other and went on to exchange their uniforms.
Sure, and they'll face each other again at least once more. I think their next league game is scheduled for February, but they will, of course, likely see each other next month for the next World Cup qualifying games as well, when they both represent the national team. That's where we'll leave it for our Korea Trending segment today. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Yeowon, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thanks, Changwon. I'll see you next time.
We continue on now to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we take a journey across the peninsula, discovering more about the country's history, culture, and travel highlights. Joining us this week is the ever-wonderful Alison Needles from the blog Moon Bear Travel. in the studio as well, no less. Ali, it's great to see you again.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be back in the studio.
Yes, hope you've been well.
You too.
Yes, it's good to have you back. Now, last week we started a four-part series introducing the second season of the Feel the Rhythm of Korea video series created by the Korea Tourism Organization. And we're continuing on from that. To start, Hannah covered two videos showing us both the old and new neighborhoods of Seoul. This week, though, we're venturing outside of the capital region with the rustic streets and landscapes of Korea's smaller cities taking center stage. So, Ali, which cities will you be introducing us to today?
So, the two cities that I'll be talking about today are Daegu and Suncheon. So, Daegu is located in Gyeongsangbuk-do, or North Gyeongsang Province, and Suncheon is located in Jeollanam-do, or South Jeolla Province. So, Daegu is kind of in the middle of the country, and Suncheon is in the very southern part of the country.
Right, so it's the Daegu and Suncheon episodes of the KTO video series. And have you been to these cities yourself, Ali?
So, very sadly, I had planned to go to Daegu. And Daegu was kind of the center of the first big outbreak during the coronavirus pandemic in Korea. And I was going to go literally 2 days after that happened. So, I haven't been there since. I haven't gone. So, I'm really excited to finally go when I get the chance. But I did go to Suncheon a couple years ago. And I was actually thankful that I had never been to the places that are in the video.
Right.
We're going to talk about today, so that gives me a reason to go back and see more.
Right, so you've been learning a lot as well. And it just shows as well that these video series is not only showcasing the obvious tourist locations, but also some places off the beaten path as well. Let's start with the video introducing us to Daegu, as it's likely where many listeners have been to or at least heard of. What can we see then in the Feel the Rhythm of Korea video for the Daegu version, which what makes these particular landmarks so special?
So there is a lot in the Daegu video. The first thing you see when you watch the video is something called Buksong Industrial Tool Street, which I find very interesting as the first choice for Daegu. This is an alleyway that was started by a group of 11 people around 1947, and they were collecting these random industrial tools that the American military forces had disposed of after Japanese colonization. And so they were kind of picking up things that were not manufactured in Korea, and they started to sell them. And now it has this huge community of over 500 businesses, and there are new industrial shops popping up all the time. So it's just really interesting history. And it has a really cool kind of gritty feeling to it. Good place for photos. And you can meet some nice people there as well. And there's also the Yakjeon Alley. This is another kind of historical place. It's a traditional and tourist shopping area. You can buy all kinds of traditional teas there. And maybe what it's most famous for is its medicinal herb market. There are also medicine clinics there, so doctors that you can go see. And they also have a lot of popular ginseng shops that are really high quality. So this is really good if you're interested in traditional Korean medicine. And the next one that you can see is Gwanmun Vintage Market. So you can get anything here, not just vintage clothes. You can get food like pig's head. You can get specialty baked goods. But they are most famous for their secondhand clothing, shoes, and accessories.
Right, so these very interesting markets and alleyways are featured here in this episode. From these places you've mentioned already, and from what people will notice from the video, is that Daegu is quite a metropolitan city as well. It's the third largest city in Korea in terms of population, but also has a strong link to the past as well, which is featured in the video. Can you tell us more about the historical places that we see?
So the first historical place was the House of Lee Sang-hwa, which I don't think is a person many people know. He was a nationalist poet, so he very strongly resisted Japanese colonization. And you can visit his house, where he lived from 1939 until his death in 1943. And in 1999, this house was actually protected by the citizens, the local citizens of Daegu, who really pressed the local community to save it. And finally, it was donated to the city of Daegu in 2005 only. So this is a really amazing house. It's a traditional Korean house, and it also has a bit of a more modern history. And the next place you can see in the video is the March 1st Independent Movement Road. And this comes from the March 1st Independence Movement. And so that was March 8th, 1919, students from high schools around Daegu kind of gathered there secretly, and they rallied against, you know, Japanese colonization in this alleyway. Mm. At the time, it was actually a pine forest, and now it has 90 stairs that you can walk down, and there are photographs of people who participated in the movement and photographs from the movement. So it's really moving and really inspiring, I think, to learn more about the local history. And the last one is the Anjirang Gopchang Alley, which is famous for selling intestines of cattle, which people love to eat. So it's kind of local delicacy. I've never eaten it. They're like fried up, right?
Yes. Gopchang, it's fried up intestines. It can be quite daunting at first, right, for those trying it for the first time. But the greasy, barbecued bits of intestines are absolutely a mouth-watering delicacy once you get used to it, and perfect with some beer as well.
What do they taste like? Because I'm a vegetarian, actually.
I see.
So I've never had it. Are they? Is it like crunchy or?
It's chewy. It's quite chewy. Yes.
Okay.
It's a lovely greasiness. I can't really explain to you, but yeah, great with beer and great with soju as well. So that's a great place, interesting place that they've highlighted there, and some historical places, some very important historical places that they featured as well. Let's briefly talk about the song that's featured in the video. As we mentioned last week, all the songs are inspired by Korean traditional music. The song for Daegu is a sort of catchy hip-hop song that also sounds like Seotaeji's Come Back Home for anyone who knows their 90s Korean pop. Can you tell us a bit more about the history behind this music?
Yeah, so this song in the video is a rap version of a minyo, which is a folk song called Kwe Jina Ching Ching Nane, which is a very fun and lighthearted song. It was used to pass the time for labor workers a long time ago. It's created by Big Naughty and EMET. I'm not sure if it's EMET or Emmet sound. This song has actually been covered a lot before. There are trot versions of it. There's a popular singer, Jessie, who had a version of it. Mm. But I really, really love this one. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's a great version. Also, the dance routine in the video is something fun as well. Okay, let's move swiftly on to our second video of the week, Suncheon. Now, this video stands out in terms of the series as it tells more of a story rather than focusing on landmarks, right, Ali?
Absolutely. This is kind of a very special video that shows us the real countryside and the real rural living that so many Korean people experience, but we don't see in Seoul. Mm. So the two places they feature here are Yogok Village and Gusan Village. And these are places with a lot of older adults. I'm talking like grandma, grandpa age. And it shows them relaxing after a long day of work in the fields because they're actually celebrating one of the neighbor's 100th birthday. So you get to see a birthday party. And they're drinking very expensive ginseng liquor and makgeolli, which is a rice liquor. They're eating together. Their native Korean dogs are even there. They have the Jindo dog. And I think the ginseng really stands out as well because it's such an important thing to the older generation of Korea. It's used for just benefiting your health overall, strengthening your immune system. So this is such a nice gift to see at the birthday party. I really love this video.
Yeah, it's a really charming and heartwarming video showing a slice of rural life away from the bustling streets of the big cities. And the song, it's also quite unique in this video too, isn't it?
Yeah, I had to do some extra research because I didn't realize it was a traditional song. It sounds so modern. And the song that it's based off of is called Se Taryong. It's an R&B version of an old folk song that talks about the sounds and the motions of different birds on a bright and beautiful spring day. This version is called View, so they changed the name, and it's created by Trade L. And they're kind of focusing on lifestyle, harmonizing with nature here. And yeah, I really like it. I was so shocked. I had to double check, make sure that they were still doing the same traditional folk song theme.
Sure. And for our listeners who might want to know more about how to reach all these places, where could they find this information, Ali?
Right. Well, there's a lot to talk about here. So please go to moonbeartravel.com. This is my Korea travel website. I will have all of the information, all of the addresses, opening times already listed for the Daegu and Suncheon videos on my website. So go check out the blog.
Yes. And as I mentioned last week, for those who want to see the videos, you can find them on the KTO's YouTube page called Imagine Your Korea and search for Feel the Rhythm of Korea. And you should be able to find all the videos from this season and last season as well. Ali, thank you for introducing us to these great videos and places to visit. And we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you. I really look forward to visiting both of these cities again.
You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio. If you ever miss an episode of Korea 24, you can always catch up by downloading our podcast. Simply search for the KBS World Radio app wherever you get your applications from. After downloading the app, select the menu icon in the top left-hand corner. A drop-down menu will then appear from where you can select Podcasts, then Programs, then Korea 24. There, you'll find a list of all our previous episodes for you to download and enjoy on your own time. And don't forget to follow our Twitter page, at KBS Korea 24, to get the latest updates on our show every day.
We've come now to our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who kindly provide us with their early editions to make this segment possible. So our thanks goes out to them for that. Joining me now in the studio is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who's been looking through those papers for us. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you again.
So what do you have for us today?
We're going to head to the national section of the Korea Times. Lee Hae-in writes about local efforts to improve the treatment of abandoned animals here in South Korea. Lee starts off her piece with the sobering fact that the country sees around 130,000 companion animals abandoned each year, with only about half of those making it to shelters, and a quarter of those animals euthanized due to a lack of resources. That's according to the Korea's Animal and Plant Quarantine Agency. So, in an effort to end this vicious cycle, the Bom Center, literally Dobom Senta, was founded in November 2020 in Paju, Gyeonggi Province by one of the better-known animal protection civic groups, Korea Animal Rights Advocates, or better known as KARA.
Right, the Bom Center, that gets its name from the Korean word bom, that means look into and to care for. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the center was to end this vicious cycle then, to improve the treatment of such animals. Mm. How so?
He writes that the Bom Center aims to be the Korean version of Tierheim, which is the name for animal protection centers in Germany, known for their advanced and animal-friendly facilities. And the Bom Center doesn't conform to the typical animal shelter you'd see here, allowing animals to maintain their natural behavior. For example, dogs and cats are separated entirely, and the animals of similar size and health condition share a space much larger than the government set standard. Rooms are also soundproof, well-ventilated, and maintained at optimum room temperature. The center also has an animal hospital, professionally staffed, outdoor spaces, a garden, a training area, and even walking paths. Because of these optimum conditions, animals are quickly rehomed both here and abroad. And if you see, if you look at the Times, they have a picture there, and it shows some of the outdoor sections. It looks really wonderful, real grass. So to read more about how KARA and the center are trying to set an example for how the rescue shelter industry needs to be developed and maintained, pick up tomorrow's Times.
Yes, we've talked a lot about these sorts of stories on Morning Edition Preview about how the situation for dogs and dog shelters are improving. Another sign then that this is happening, and especially the money that's being invested here in this center, it sounds like that's part of that movement as well.
That's right.
Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
The Korea Herald's Im Min-byul writes about how the South Korean government will push for the expansion of the Korean Gallery at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, better known as the Met. Now, this is according to the Culture Minister Hwang Hee at a press event with New York correspondents on Thursday. In fact, Hwang was at the Met on Monday along with the First Lady Kim Jong-suk and BTS, and the minister said that the Met's director and CEO suggested moving the Arts of Gallery Korea to a bigger space.
Yes, and as ever, BTS's visit to the Met did catch the sight of their fans as well, who commented on it. Now, does Im then, in his piece, talk about why the expansion of the Arts of Korea Gallery is possibly in the works?
Yeah, so it could be for a few reasons. The gallery itself is actually quite dated. It was established in 1998, and it's quite smaller than the exhibition halls of China and Japan. That's according to the Ministry of Culture, Sports, and Tourism. And the thing is, the ministry is also seeking to hold an exhibition at the Met with pieces from the massive art collection donated by the family of late Samsung chairman Lee Gun-hee. Now, this is interesting because, according to Hwang, Lee's donations gives us being South Korea, some leverage to negotiate exhibitions, exchanges, and expansions with overseas museums. Now, I'm just like, be careful, Mr. Minister, you don't want to show your entire hand here, but I think that's really fascinating because of this donated collection. At any rate, we could be seeing a new and improved Arts of Korea Gallery at the Met, sometime in the future. So to read more about it, pick up tomorrow's Herald.
So Korean culture making further waves, it seems, in New York as well. Let's finish up our Morning Edition preview segment there. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's all for our show today as well. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more news, views and reviews from Korea. Till next time, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.